You are listening to the Hirschsprung's Hour on UK Health Radio, where I interview incredible people with a connection to Hirschsprung's disease and other associated conditions, such as IBD, IBS, Crohn's, colitis, and ulcerative colitis. Each week, I bring you a new and exciting interview with people from all walks of life, including charity founders, models, and professional sports people. We go through the ups and downs of having Hirschsprung's with a positive message throughout.
Hello and welcome to episode 64 of Tom's Hirschsprung's podcast. I am delighted to be joined all the way from South Africa by Anri Gibson. Anri, welcome to the podcast.
Thanks. Thanks so much. Thank you for having me. I'm really excited to be here and to share our journey. And hopefully there's some families out there that can relate. Because I also want to share a positive experience as well. So hopefully that will resonate with people.
Absolutely. Well, that's all we're about here as well, about sort of, yes, we go through sort of ups and downs, but try and keep it, we sort of keep it upbeat. We don't gloss over the bad stuff as such, but it's very much a life of ups and downs as Hirschsprung's, as I'm sure you're very aware at this stage. But yes, so if you wouldn't mind, we'll go sort of straight from the beginning.
Yeah, thank you. So I want to highlight, we actually do have a daughter who's 3 years old. So she, I mean, everything with her is normal, healthy. And then about a year and a half later, so we've got a very small age gap, I fell pregnant with our son. Had a normal pregnancy, healthy, had all my scans, everything was fine, had a cesarean, gave birth, I don't know, but in South Africa, I think this is common. They do the ACPA score at birth, and they basically rate everything of the baby, and his was a 10. They look at everything, breathing, physically, everything. So his score was 10. I was like, okay, great. Immediately breastfed, he latched, everything went well. I mean, then was a second time mom. I sort of knew what to expect. I had my baby with me and then send him to the nursery because I was obviously extremely tired. So usually send him to the nursery for a few hours and then they bring him back to me. They told me he did have his first nappy. So all was good. So he did actually pass the meconium nappy and thereafter had a few stools with me as well. In South Africa, we also, it depends on yourself and your gynae. We spend about 3 to 4 nights in the hospital after cesarean. So I was staying there for 3 nights. And on the 4th day, when we were about to be discharged, we noticed that he was interested in feeding, but once, you know, he latched, he pulled away. So he was like sort of struggling and not taking in any milk. This was on a Sunday. So our pediatrician who I've been with our daughter, who's absolutely amazing, was not on call that particular day. So she saw us the Friday, but the pediatrician who stood in saw us and he also noted Lo was a little bit lethargic. But he did have a jaundice score, not too high, but they said, maybe it's the jaundice. Let's treat him for that. So let's go home and set up phototherapy at home, have a nurse come and see us at home. Because obviously you want to go home and you don't want to spend too much time in the hospital. So I was happy with that approach. And we thought maybe that's why he's a little bit lethargic. So went home on the Sunday, that was day 4, struggled that whole Sunday because this was the morning for him to properly feed. So the nursing sister was there, so she helped me, lactation specialist, so she helped me to try and tube feed. So we tried that, we tried lots of different things while he was also under the lights, but still like didn't really... Yeah, I mean, from what I could see, he would take in some of the milk and then he would vomit, but not bile. So I thought maybe it's reflux, not very concerning at that point. Then I think Monday morning at about 2 or 3 a.m., He had no wet nappy since when we were discharged from the hospital. So I knew with all of those feedings that we were trying to give him that he hasn't taken anything in, hence there's no wet nappies. So like in South Africa, we're very blessed. We've got close relationships with the doctors. My husband is also a medical professional in the hospital. So we actually phoned the pediatrician in the early hours and we said, you need to meet us at emergency, like something is not right. So at 3 a.m., we raced to the hospital. Luckily, we had grandparents staying with us, so they looked after our daughter. Went to the hospital, got admitted. Immediately, they placed him again in the incubator under the light, still thinking that it's jaundice. Started doing lots of tests because it presented maybe like an infection, maybe had some sort of infection. So they started him on medication and they started running blood tests. So this was, again, still the pediatrician that was on call. So in the early morning hours, Monday morning, I think at about 7 a.m., I messaged our ped, who was not on call over the weekend. So I said, like, I don't know if you've heard, but we're in hospital. And immediately within the next 30 minutes, she was there and she looked at Lo and she was like, this is not the same baby that she saw on Friday, the last day she saw him before we got discharged. And she's like, she would have not just discharged him because she saw him on the Friday and she knew what he was like and what he looked like at birth. And she said, something is wrong. Some of the results came back. It actually showed like some pus cells in his urine and very weird results according to her perspective, and she was very confused with what is wrong. They thought maybe it was a kidney pipe that's leaking. So he had multiple, I cannot remember what you called the scans, but he immediately had some abdominal sonars and additional tests to check if it's a kidney pipe that's leaking. And everything that she did sort of came back negative to what her initial thinking was, because of course he did have that nappy and he did pass stools initially. So she called in one of the professors who was a pediatric surgeon to come and look maybe if there's like some surgical intervention that's needed. He consulted with Lo. He's actually a specialist in Hirschsprung's disease, but to him also didn't present as Hirschsprung's disease. So he said, no, surgically, it doesn't seem like there's anything wrong. She needs to do additional tests. So we carried on with testing. And this was now 3 or 4 days of just running tests, trying to eliminate like sort of all of her thinkings, like process of elimination, literally. But obviously Lo was still not feeding. So he was getting weaker, which was a concern because he could tolerate like low volumes of milk, 10, 20 mils he could tolerate before vomiting. So after she's done multiple tests, she actually said we need to be transferred to a different hospital where there's a neonatologist because she needs to consult with the neonatologist as well. So we got transferred to a different hospital where there was a more specialized team looking after Lo. And still, I'm just going to fast track a little. Probably 2 weeks later, we still had no diagnosis. So the decision was made to insert a Broviac line for Lo, to feed him through a Broviac line, because the lines that he had was leaking and pulling out. So they actually went with a Broviac line, which he got in theater. So at least we knew he was now getting sufficient feeding, medical feed or that TPN, while we are figuring out what is wrong with our child. Mm. Then there came a point where they thought maybe it's a metabolic disorder or condition. So they did lots of tests, but that takes quite a while for the results to come out. So we were sort of like waiting for those tests. And the surgeons didn't want to intervene until the metabolic test results came out. So while we were waiting for those results, I did highlight again to her, and I've referred to this in our conversation, that Lo had a white forelock, so a white patch of hair in front, which That Pete was saying maybe this looks like Waardenburg syndrome. And one of the Waardenburg syndromes, there's a correlation with Hirschsprung's disease. I cannot remember which type, whether it was 3 or 4. There's 4 types. So she was saying to the surgeons that she believes this is Waardenburg and it's Hirschsprung's, and they should have a look at Hirschsprung's, but they were still reluctant because Lo was passing stool and he wasn't presenting as a normal Hirschsprung's diagnosis or PD that they've seen in the past. In parallel to this, we had a geneticist come to do genetic testing, which was sent to Germany to see if it is indeed Waardenburg while we're still waiting to figure out what his diagnosis was. They at least wanted to confirm if it is Waardenburg, because with Waardenburg in conjunction with Hirschsprung's, there can be other issues as well, like lack of hearing, etc. So we also did the genetic testing. Then in the meantime, the metabolic test results came back and it was negative. So there was no disorders that they could see. So our pediatrician told the surgeons, this is now probably 3, approaching almost 4 weeks later, with still no diagnosis, that they need to surgically go and have a look if there's something wrong, because they maybe thought it's like the bands of the abdomen that's flopping over, so his belly is flopping over. I don't know. I cannot remember all the details. But they did a laparoscopic surgery and had a look on the outside of the organs if they could see anything strange, ligaments pulling, muscular issues around the gut area. And they didn't find anything. So came back out of theater, nothing. Everything looks perfect. So then the neonatologist also suggested that they do a full thickness rectum biopsy. So they actually, a few days later, you went in for a gastroscopy and colonoscopy, and they did biopsies throughout the whole GI tract, so small intestine, large intestine, rectum. But then, of course, it takes about 5-6 days for these results to become available, and we just kept on doing what we're doing. He had the Broviac line, he was getting feed. We just went to visit him every day because we couldn't stay with him in the NICU. So we had visiting hours, just visited him every day and basically waited for the results. The Waardenburg results came back and it all was negative. So there was no genetic mutation. So there was no correlation between his white forelock and Hirschsprung's, which to this day is still very weird. But we are grateful for that, because that sort of pursued the Hirschsprung's disease diagnosis path. So I remember the day, it was on a Saturday, we were playing with our daughter at home because there's certain hours in the day that the babies need to sleep, so we're not allowed in the NICU. And the pediatrician phoned me. So she said she's got a tentative diagnosis. It looks like it's Hirschsprung's disease, but they need a bigger biopsy to confirm for sure. But that's the tentative diagnosis. So immediately she called the surgeons, etc. So she said, I think it was a few days after the Tuesday or the Wednesday, he's going to go into theater and they're going to do the biopsies with the pathologist in theater, because she doesn't want to send him just for another biopsy to theater and have him get anesthetic multiple times. So the pathologist, they apparently were about 10 to 12 people in theater. While they were literally doing a biopsy, passing it to the pathologist and checking, and then they would go up higher and do another biopsy again to just determine if there's a transverse section where maybe the nerve cells have like jumped a certain area, etc.
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good. The station that makes you feel good.
So this was about almost 6 hours that he was in theater while they were doing this. And I remember we were sitting outside the theater room or the ward waiting, and got a call. The pediatrician was actually also sitting with us. So the theater phoned the pediatrician and they were saying it is Hirschsprung's disease. There was no nerve cells in the rectum. They went further up and they did find nerve cells by the, oh, I cannot remember what you call that portion in the colon. Anyways, they did found nerve cells in portions of the large intestine. So it's a very small section, but they did form a stoma. And I remember like bursting out into tears. And I'm like, what? Like a stoma? Like, this was like, I didn't even think about a stoma because a lot of the research that I did was usually if they find it, they do pull through immediately. So I thought if they found it, they would just remove that portion, do the pull through. But yeah, they actually did a stoma formation. He came out of theater. I was like so shocked with like your newborn baby. He was about 6 or 7 weeks old at that point in time when he had the stoma formation. And our P just told me like the stoma basically saved his life. So like you just need to deal with this. Put on your big girl panties. The stoma saved his life. Your baby is going to be fine. We've got a diagnosis. And it was quite overwhelming because the next morning, immediately, the stoma clinic was there with me teaching me how to work and deal with the stoma. And this professor, I said, the pediatric surgeon, he's about 75 years old and he's got a mentee who works with him. I'm so grateful for the two of them. They were an amazing team. But he explained to me that his approach is to do a stoma. Whether they could have done pull through or not, they felt like his bowel needed to heal. You only get one chance to reattach. And for them, it was more important to do the stoma and let everything just settle before we do the reversal. And, you know, I was a little bit annoyed initially because I thought you could have done it. But in hindsight, I mean, this was the best that could have happened. So we had the diagnosis of Hirschsprung's. We had the stoma. We now knew it's not Waardenburg. And then probably a week later, seeing that the stoma was working, we got discharged. And then it was like going home with a baby with a stoma bag. I mean, I was so overwhelmed. But luckily, we do have amazing support. And we had a stoma clinic I used to visit. They actually loved Lo there because they only get a baby maybe once a year in the clinic. So everybody loved him so much. I mean, when we walked in there, he was so like spoiled by all the nurses and the staff members. But nonetheless, we then had the stoma journey. So he got the stoma at about 7 weeks. And then we had to do dilations at home once a day for as long until he got the reversal. So he needed to keep it stretched down there. So that was his approach. Our pediatric surgeon's approach was to do dilations. So we did that. And then we had follow-up appointments. Stoma was working well. They had a look down there. It wasn't too tight. So that was all good. Then he had the pull-through, or not the pull-through, the pull-through. He had the pull-through scheduled first. So they do the pull through and the reversal into different surgeries. I don't know if that's the same approach, but we then went back into hospital when he was about 8 months old to do the pull through. So that wasn't too bad. I mean, so they went in and they basically, as how they explained it to me, was removed that diseased portion and basically almost form a new rectum, but because his was down very low. Low segment. So had that fixed, but obviously still had the stoma. We were discharged. Everything was good. I think we were in the hospital for about 5 days. He responded really well. And then after the pull through, about a month or a month and a half later, he would have stoma reversal surgery. So he was probably 9.5 months at this point, but happy, thriving, growing well, eating, being normal. And then when we had reversal, to me, that was very traumatic. I wish people informed me that the reversal was the hardest part, actually, for me, because after they do the reversal, obviously, it's nil per mouth until they pass stool. And we weren't allowed to feed because they didn't want stool to pass there, so to let it like heal for a few days. So I think for about 5 days we didn't feed him per mouth. He still had his Broviac line, which we were feeding him through. But yeah, it was just difficult not feeding a 9-month-old baby per bottle and he's crying for a bottle. So that was really tough. We did have some complications with, not with the procedure itself, but just with some of his lines and stuff leaking. He was so unhappy. He was sore. I think what the surgeon also explained to me, removing a stoma and removing or going through those muscular layers is very painful for them. So like the crunching up position was really tough. So we were in hospital for about 8 days because they wanted to see that he then, once we started feeding, that he passes stool. We did have the dreaded nappy rash that everybody tells you about. That was really bad. So we did have the bad nappy rash. And then, yeah, we were discharged and he was recovering well. He was pooing on a normal schedule, like a normal baby. He was very, you could see that it was a weird sensation for him or something to adapt to. So each time when he felt the urge that he had to poo or pass a stool, it was, he cried quite a lot. I think he was obviously just not used to that feeling. So it was very traumatic for all of us. And because we did the dilations, he had this like connotation with the nappy changing station and the dilation. So when he wanted to change his nappy, he was so unhappy because he thought, you know, we're probably going to do dilations. But yeah, that probably carried on for about 4 or 5 weeks where he just had to get used to the feeling, I guess. I'm not sure. But then thereafter, it sort of got better. I mean, he was happy. He wasn't in pain anymore. The nappy rash was gone. I tried everything. Like, I even got a recommendation that you should use the stoma powder for nappy rash, which I still had loads of, which I did, and it did help. But anyways, about 2 months after that, he had a checkup procedure where they wanted to, he had to go into theater again, and they just wanted to check that there's no, it's not too narrow, and if it is, they would have surgically, like, or just stretch it, but that was not needed. So they went, they checked, and everything was fine, and we were discharged the same day. Yeah, and I guess that was basically his last checkup after the diagnosis. Was probably at about 11 months old, and then there was nothing concerning or wrong. And since then, he is thriving. He hasn't had any, like, post that, we haven't had any issues or any constipation. He's actually passing stool really well. He is big. He's chunky. We had a little bit of a initially delay with, like, tummy time. He wasn't too happy on his tummy with his stoma bag. So I was a little bit concerned because our daughter was like walking at 10 months old. But Lo catched up at 11 months. He started walking and running at 12 months. So he's like very busy. Guess he wanted to keep up with his little sister. But y'all, what I wanted to say is friends, family, and people who see him, who knows about his history and his journey, cannot believe that, you know, this little boy has been through so much. But he, besides the scars, but it's not a lot, the stoma scar is probably the biggest one. But besides that, you wouldn't even tell that there was anything wrong. But with his whole journey, the surgeons did say, because even the day he went in to do the biopsies again with the pathologist in theater, the surgeon told me it's not Hirschsprung's disease. So he was convinced up until that point in time that it wasn't Hirschsprung's disease. But afterwards he told us, like, there's just some patients that prove you differently. So they do like a write-up of his scenario to share, because it wasn't presenting as your normal Hirschsprung's diagnosis. Baby, you didn't have that initial nappy. But yeah, since then, which was great, is obviously the podcast and relating to other parents who went through something similar. And I felt like in South Africa, there wasn't enough awareness. So I registered with Rare Diseases, which is an organization that creates awareness around rare diseases. But there's not also a lot of movement that happened there. We worked very closely with a dietitian who specialized in Hirschsprung's. And she connected me with some other moms through her network with kiddies who she's working with, which was really great. Because those moms actually wanted to chat to someone, and I've sort of been through the journey, and some of the other moms had kiddies who were a little bit older, so we formed our little own network just to tell one another, you know, it's going to be okay, like, it's going to be okay. But even just the four of us, each story is different already, which just makes it crazy. Like, each journey is not the same. Our boy doesn't, it passes about one, two, or has one to two nappies a day. We're one of the other moms, her boy had about 10, 12 nappies a day. So it was completely different. So it was nice to connect to someone who is in the same country, because obviously we can speak about the healthcare challenges or whatever the case might be, which was really great to just know that you're not the only one that's going through this. Yeah. And I just want to highlight that even though this diagnosis came upon us, I mean, everything was normal in my pregnancy and it came as a bit of a surprise and we dealt with it. It made us as a family so strong. And I wouldn't exchange the experience that we've been through because I can see he's such a resilient boy. And what he's been through obviously has shaped him into the little human that he is. And yeah, I think that the experiences he's not going to remember, but I do think that it's a character building element that he's been through. And, you know, we'll always remind him how strong he was basically since birth. And he just had all of these like challenges thrown at him. But he really is doing well. And one last comment, there's this Facebook, I'm sure most Hirschsprung's people who's affected by Hirschsprung's might know it, this huge Facebook global group, which was the only resource I could join because that's the only place I found people to connect with. And that group was very insightful, but it was also a lot of negative stories, which I'm really sorry if that's the experience. And then I do feel for those families, but it was a lot of negativity where I actually had to leave the group because I couldn't deal with all the negative comments anymore. So I literally posted our journey, a positive journey, and I left the group because I could not face all of those negativity, not negativity, but all the sad around the disease and not seeing positive stories. And that's why I thought the podcast is maybe my last way of sharing a positive experience. And yes, it was tough, but now we've got a normal, healthy boy who's living his life and he's just thriving. And then possibly close our chapter on this. I do understand that maybe, I don't know, will there be obstacles in the future? Maybe, maybe not. But we're just living in the moment for the time being. He's fine and he's healthy and we just sort of actually forget about everything. I know that was a lot, but...
No, that's a fantastic and fascinating story. I think you're absolutely right when, you know, you search for things online and you do come across a lot. I mean, I do, you know, search for a lot of things on Hirschsprung's and you do come across a lot of that negativity and each to their own. But like, I know we were talking a little bit off air about sort of this podcast and I wanted to keep it very much, you know, positive, not ignore, you know, all the stuff that's happened, but it's an up and down journey as you've just proven. But I think having that sort of, it's like you said, with the network group, having that sort of, you know, I've been through this experience and, you know, everyone goes through different experiences, but I've been through this experience and we're okay. You know, I think having that sort of light at the end of the tunnel, I think really, really helps. That's why I've joined the Facebook groups I have, just to sort of say, like, you know, got these experiences and, you know, people doing really well, thriving. Absolutely.
Sorry for interrupting. I guess that's the thing. So when we had the diagnosis and we didn't know what the future would hold and when would reversal be and what will this entail, and having the Facebook group or that group as your reference freaked me out a little. I was like, oh my word, like, what are we going to do? And my husband actually, I got obsessed with the group. I was on the group constantly relating to stories. And my husband was like, you need to stop reading every single post, every single comment on this group, because you're going to drive yourself mad. And I actually did. I was still present on the group, but I was not as much involved in reading through it. And I actually saw a counselor. I didn't feel like I needed one because I felt sort of okay throughout the journey. Yes, it was emotional, but I then made the decision to speak to somebody to make sure down the line that there's no depression or because some of the other moms that I have connected with 13, 14 months after, they did fall in some form of depression. So I wanted to avoid that and be proactive about it. So I did speak to a counselor, and I had somebody who I had sessions with. And she also asked me, like, what is your main aim of meeting with me? So I explained to her. When people asked me about his diagnosis, I burst into tears each and every time. So I sort of felt like that annoying friend who you don't want to invite to a braai anymore, because each time the topic comes up, you cry. So I was like, you know what? I want to be able to speak about it and not cry about it and share the story and share what we've been through and just be strong. And that was our main aim of the sessions. And I finally came to a point where I was like, oh, you know what? Somebody asked me about his diagnosis the other day, and I had a full-on conversation with no tears. And I guess that's why I also felt maybe it's the appropriate time to reach out to you and share our story. But the counselor also told me her advice was, share your positive story on the group, share what you wanted to share, and then leave, which I did. So I've sort of closed that chapter, and I felt like sharing it on your podcast, which again, I think is amazing, will also be again closing this chapter that we've been through. Yeah.
Yeah. I think you've done fantastically well. I mean, there are people, and I guess like myself, I didn't share until I was 31 years old. So the fact that you've done it after about 14, 15 months or so, is remarkable. So
thank you.
All kudos to you for that.
No, thank you.
So one part from the story I was just going to mention, we talked about the passing of meconium, and it being, you know, that being a real red flag and telltale sign that Hirschsprungs would potentially be present. And just double checking as well, ultra short segment, again, to have a rare condition and then have a rare part of that condition as well, must have been extraordinary.
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good. UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good.
And so, interestingly enough, it was. So I was very thankful that it was ultra short. But very interesting. So after we had our appointment with the geneticist, so we obviously had the genetic testing done, and then we saw a geneticist because we wanted to understand if we in the future would want to have a third baby, what would be the chances of this happening again. So, and I'm just going to basically relay the message of what I can remember. There was obviously more medical terms involved. But what she explained to me is crest cells, and I'm just This is going to be very simple, but crest cells are the cells that obviously, if I understood correctly, migrate through the colon, which is the nerve cells, and it starts from the top and migrates all the way down to your rectum. And obviously, he didn't migrate to that last little portion. And that is what happened with his hair. So crest cells also are the cells that carry the pigmentation for your hair color. So the same way those crest cells didn't migrate throughout the colon, it didn't migrate to that small little forelock portion in his hair. Hence, he had the white little patch. So it was actually the similar cells who migrate through the colon as the same cells to give the pigmentation to the hair. So that was very, very weird. I found it quite interesting.
Yeah, I didn't know that. And I would never... I don't think I would have ever even thought of that. I know we'd kind of spoke a little bit before, exchanged messages on Instagram, and you talked about the forelock. And I just thought that was incredibly interesting because it's not even something that even entered my mind that this would present
in
relation of Hirschsprung's.
So, when you have a look at Waardenburg and Hirschsprung's, obviously there's a correlation. But when we knew it wasn't Waardenburg because those tests came back negative, I wanted to understand why does he have the white forelock? Like, what is that then? And she then explained to me crest cells, you know, the same cells who does the migration through the colon, the nerve cells, is also the ones that gives pigmentation to the hair. So he's... just didn't migrate to that portion of his hair the same way. It didn't migrate right towards the end of his rectum. But we do love that forelock now. It makes him so unique. I get so many compliments with this little white patch of hair, which is like perfectly positioned in his fringe. Or like, yeah, it looks like people are like, that looks so cool.
Yeah.
And I told them initially I didn't like it. And initially I was like, what is this? Like, what is this white patch of hair? But after it helped the team to diagnose him, I actually fell in love with his little white forelock. So I do love it. I think it makes him unique.
Absolutely. I think so too. It's like, absolutely. Because it makes him entirely unique. Again, yeah. As I mentioned, I'd never heard of anything even remotely like that, but as you've mentioned, it makes absolute total sense as to why it had the fallout, because the cells didn't migrate in, or the crest cells didn't migrate in, etc.
Yeah.
But yeah, I find that
it's interesting.
I do. I find that absolutely fascinating, and I wonder how many people will have seen anything like that before. Because I certainly haven't, and especially the people I've talked to. I haven't seen that before, but I love the fact that you really like the forelock and embrace it. And
right, absolutely. I think,
did that, I know you said initially you weren't overly keen, but how long did that sort of take before you thought, oh, actually, this is good?
Yeah, good question. So very, very interesting. When they gave him to me right after he was born, obviously, you can't see exactly clearly what they look like until they maybe like wipe them or whatever. And on day, I think it was still day one, towards the end of day one, I was like, what is this white patch of hair? Because I then asked the Pete the next morning, I'm like, what is this? She's like, no, it looks like Waardenburg, but she's had Waardenburg's before and it's never really caused an issue. So we'll chat about that at his 6 months checkup appointment. And I remember like, taking photos and had a look at this white patch, and I'm like, this is so weird. Wasn't too keen on it. And then after they were trying to figure out his diagnosis, there was always this big commotion made about the white patch and Waardenburg and Hirschsprung's, and then it annoyed me a little bit more because now it's always this topic when people see him for the first time, they're like, oh, look at this white patch over here. And I'm was like, oh, obviously I see it. But somebody, one of the nurses, actually mentioned, like, they love it, makes him unique. He's going to be known as the boy with the little white forelock in a good way. She's like, girls are going to know he's that boy with the white hair. But anyways, long story short, my husband loved it right from the start, which I look at him and I'm like, wow, you're really amazing, because I didn't like it, but you just loved it right from the start. So I think after that sort of gave us the indication and led to the diagnosis, knowing that there's no syndrome associated with it, I came around to love it. It did take me a few weeks, but I then did really start to love it. And I don't mind sharing pictures. I mean, afterwards, I can share a picture of what it looked like after birth, because it was really white because his hair was dark. But his hair is actually a little bit blonder now, so it doesn't stand out as much. So it looks really cool. It looks like we gave him a highlight. That's what people might think.
I think people pay a lot of money for highlights like that. You got it for free?
Yeah, I know. Hey, I know. It does look like we gave him highlights. But I also connected, there was a mom who I connected with. I think she was in Australia, who also had a baby with a white forelock. Because I was now looking into white forelocks and trying to connect with people whose baby has it, who's not Wardenburg. And her baby was a little bit older, and she mentioned to me she initially also didn't like it, but now she loves it. And I think that also encouraged me to embrace his uniqueness, not only his Hirschsprung's diagnosis, but how he is different. Yeah.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Anyway. Fantastic. As we sort of circle towards the end here, I'd like to talk a little bit just about the future. I know you've said that your son's getting on really, really well, which is so, so good to hear. And that you're also, as a family, sort of big sports fans as well. Is your son also into sports as well?
Yeah, so what we can see compared to our daughter, like very active, very busy. I'm not used to boys. I was used to a girl. So having that element in our house is crazy, jumping, climbing, really doing everything after his sister. So my husband and I are sports enthusiasts. He used to play rugby professionally after school. I used to play hockey and lots of athletics. So we're really a sporty family. So my biggest concern was I just wanted him to be normal and healthy, whether he's sporty or not, but to be able to partake in whatever he wants, just to be healthy. So with regards to his diagnosis and how it's managed in South Africa, again, we're so lucky that we close with our ped. So I don't think I would ever move to a general practitioner. We continuously take him to his pediatrician because she knows his history. We've traveled a little bit with him as well, just locally, but to different parts of the country. And when he does get sick, I'm like, we need to get on a flight back to Cape Town. Like, nobody else is looking at our baby. He's not getting admitted elsewhere. So we literally have her on WhatsApp, and she's basically part of our family because we're so grateful for her and the role that she's played in Lowe's journey. But she basically keeps a close eye on him. And again, we haven't had any concerns or reasons besides like your common cold and flu and whatever to really be back there. But we will eventually, we did chat to the surgeon maybe in 2 years' time, just take him back for a checkup. There's no particular reason. They will just again check that it's stretched enough down there and it is on the size, or I don't know what you want to call it, that it is supposed to be at. But there was no reason for them also to say that we need to routinely come every X amount of years. Their biggest aim was to have him in a social environment, being able to, I think they call it, I'm going to forget the word, and my husband and I love the word, but basically what it was is that in a social environment, he needs to be able to not have accidents when he's older. He needs to be able to control his bowel. And that was our main aim, was to not damage the nerve so that he has control there. And well, so far, everything is functioning the way it should. But we definitely partner with our pediatrician. I have to say, it's just nice knowing that she's a call away and that she knows his whole journey.
Fantastic. Well, thank you. Thank you ever so much for coming on. It has been an absolute pleasure to talk to you and to listen and share in your story. And I guess it remains for me to just say that I wish you, your son, and your entire family all the very, very best for the future. And thank you so much for coming on.
No, thank you. And again, I want to highlight the fact that you've got this forum, and I mean, you reached somebody in South Africa to come and share their journey. It's amazing. It just goes to show that it really touches people across the globe, and it's a relevant topic, and it's a disease that needs to be spoken of more. I feel like people need to be educated on it. People need to be aware that it's this type of condition, and they need to know that they're not alone. So I just want to say, like, your podcast has touched me. And I really hope that this story can inspire other families as well and continue to do the great work and have this page up and running. And I will definitely refer it to some of my other moms who went through something similar. If you maybe want to have some more South Africans on your podcast, they can also share their journeys. But thank you so much for your time as well. Really appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thank you, Tom. Much.
Thank you for listening to the Hirschsprungs Hour on UK Health Radio. You can find me on Facebook under Tom's Hirschsprungs Podcast or Instagram on Tom's_Hirschsprungs_podcast. I hope you enjoyed the show, and we'll bring you another episode soon.